Well, we're starting our last session for today. We have two speakers, Professor Stuart Elden and Dr. Ariel Endel. First will be Stuart Elden, who is a professor of political geography at Durham University, and from September will be professor of political theory and geography at the University of Warwick. He is the editor of Environment and Planning D. That's the first time I learned about the ABCD. Environment and Planning D, Society and Space. Well, I'm an alien resident. His book, The Birth of Territory, will be published by University of Chicago Press in August. And he will speak about Earth.
Thank you very much. Chaim, Adi, Ariel, for the invitation. And the first request was that I came to speak about territory. And I said I'd done my work on this, and that I'd really like to do something else. And I proposed this notion of Earth. But I found this paper incredibly difficult to write. And I had some sense of why I found it so difficult to write, and still some uncertainty about why I found it so difficult to write. But I think part of the reason I found it so difficult to write was precisely because I could write on territory and yet didn't want to, that meant I couldn't write on the question of Earth. In other words, I really should have known this. I knew the work that went into the work I've done on territory, which would have enabled me to give the talk I would have liked to have given on the concept of Earth, and yet obviously I didn't have the time and I didn't have the energy, in a sense, to do that work. So perhaps I should have done a different concept, like hubris or something. So this paper, in a sense, is a set of my questions and indications towards the paper I think should be written that would be adequate to the title that you see on the screen. Geopolitics today has, I think, effectively become a synonym for global politics. And armchair strategists still come up with their grand plans for understanding and changing the world, while critical geopolitics scholars offer broad analyses of just such strategies and the interlinked relations of capital, state power, nationalism, and territory. So Robert Kaplan's recent The Revenge of Geography seems destined to be all that many people, especially in policy circles, actually learn about geography, as if exhuming Mackinder was the way forward, or they read Harm de Bly's latest offering of Why Geography Matters. But even critical geopolitics work tends to think of this as the global or as world politics, new ways of understanding and making sense of that particular scale. But could geopolitics be rethought in a way that's closer to the etymological roots of the word as earth politics, but for a progressive set of political purposes? Because geopolitics literally does mean the politics of the geo, the politics of the earth or of land, or the planet or world, and each of those terms would need to be thought carefully both in relation to and distinction from each other and from a notion of the global. I don't think we can collapse those notions into each other in any straightforward way. But here what I want to do is to try and offer some reflections on the concept or the question of the Earth. But what is the Earth? And the philosopher John Salis, I think, says something useful on this about how complicated this notion is. What is the Earth, he says? Is the Earth even such that it has a what, a TST? Or does it have a sense only in some other sense? How is one to delimit the sense of the word? What kind of word is Earth? Is it a proper noun, the name of a unique individual, Earth, the planet Earth? Or is it a common noun, a word that signifies a universal sense but that happens to refer only to a single individual, to what is called the Earth? Is that to which the word refers, by way of its sense, not always something, also something else distinguishable from this individual? For there are occasions in one which says not the Earth, but simply Earth, as one also says water, fire, air, designating what within the schema of production would be identified as material and conceptualized philosophically as a matter, but now outside the schema would be reconfigured monstrologically as elemental. Thus the word functions as an index of three kinds, of the individual, Earth, of the universal and only secondarily through this of the individual, the Earth, and a third kind that has been thought as materiality, but is now outside the schema of production to be thought as elemental, Earth. And it's predominantly the last of those three senses that I want to try and think about and focus on today, although the sense starts to pervade into those others. There's no straightforward way that we can draw a line between those three. But it is that material, elemental, indeed earthy sense that I want to try and discuss. Now, the term earth, the word earth in English, can be traced back to Anglo-Saxon roots. The word eorth is found in the Beowulf poem, for instance, in phrases such as Eardsella, an earth hall, and Eardraka, an earth dragon. There's a range of related terms in Germanic languages, eortha in Old English, eartha in Old Frisian, eartha in Old Anglo-Saxon, erde in Old High German, from which we get the English earth, the German erde, and the Dutch aarde. But English isn't simply formed from Germanic roots. The importance of the Norman conquest in the 11th century is linguistic alongside the political, social, and economic considerations of that conquest. And indeed, the marks in the language can help us to understand some of those other factors. One of my favourite examples of the kind of history of concepts and the history of words comes in Sir Walter Scott's novel Ivanhoe, where he's telling a story about how a Saxon peasant is told that there is a reason for the difference between the names given to animals and to the meat taken from those animals. Swine, ox, and calves are tended by Saxons, but are eaten as pork, beef, and veal by Normans. The first set of words are of Anglo-Saxon origin, the latter set are Norman French. In Shakespeare, the word earth is used, I think, often with a real terminological precision. It plays a particularly important role along with the word land and a very rare instance of the word territory in Shakespeare's play King Lear. Lear threatens his two eldest daughters, these are the two daughters that have professed their love for him in the opening scene and inherited his kingdom, and then betray him. And he threatens them with this passage: "Know you, unnatural hags, I will have such revenge on you both that all the world shall... I will do such things, what they are yet I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth." And that brief passage with the linking of world, terror, and earth is suggestive of a whole range of relations. And earth as the element earth is used in a description of Lear's madness as the winds that blow the earth into the sea, and to describe another character who's only feigning madness, Edgar, disguised as poor Tom, as the poor creature of earth. But there's two other uses of the word earth to refer to Lear's youngest daughter Cordelia that are perhaps the most interesting in the play. Cordelia is the daughter who had refused to profess her love obsequiously to her father in the opening scene and ends up being disinherited as a result of this. But she's the one who truly loves Lear the most. And so when she comes back towards the end of the play, she's seeking to restore Lear to mental health, to redeem him, to restore the kingdom back to him, and so on. And she calls for all the blessed secrets, all you unpublished virtues of the earth, spring with my tears. That her antidote to Lear's madness, provoked by the terrors of the earth he had wished on her sisters, is her love, bringing forth the things that the earth can provide, the secret restorative herbs that may be able to address Lear's madness. That the love that she's refused to declare at the beginning of the play is proven and redeemed at the end. But it has a tragic ending. Cordelia dies with Lear declaring she's dead as earth. So earth then in Lear figures in a number of ways as this element and this relation between the characters in the play. And it figures in a more figurative sense than the very concrete land politics and territory politics that actually structures the main parts of the narrative of the play. It's not simply the division of Lear's kingdom between, he hopes, his three daughters but becomes his two daughters, but it's also in the subplot where the Duke of Gloucester and the inheritance of his land, his wealth in a smaller scale, between his legitimate son and his illegitimate son, between Edgar and Edmund. And the argument of the illegitimate son, who is described at one point as you unpossessing bastard, somebody who is unable to inherit land, and the attempt that he has to try to disinherit his legitimate brother from taking on that. So there's a territory politics, a land politics, and a kind of earth politics that runs through Lear, a geopolitics in the sense that I want to try to retrieve. You could also do something, I think I've tried to do this elsewhere, with Richard II and the kind of land and earth politics that works through that play. Now, something similar to that English word earth can be found in other languages, particularly in the French, with Latin antecedents pertaining to this notion of the earth. So Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, for example, is Les Damnés de la Terre. And the French terre and the Latin terra form the root of many other English words that we would think of as earthy or earthly, as having that kind of relation. Terrestrial, terrain, even the dog a terrier comes from that same root, from the Latin. It also comes in other words that we've taken directly into the language: terra firma, terra incognita, terra nullius. And there's another root in Latin to words that appear similar that actually has a different, distinct history. So terrare in Latin means to frighten or to warn off. And this is obviously the root of words such as terror, terrorism, terrify, and so on. But there's been a debate for some time as to whether the root of the word territory is terra, land or earth, or terrare, to frighten or to scare away. The territorium in Latin, the argument has been made. William Connolly, Barry Hindus, Mark Nearclass, and others have tried to make this argument that a territorium is not simply a place around a place, kind of a land with a surrounding area, but it's a place from which people are frightened away from, or people are scared away from, and that the relation between terror and territory they make as an etymological argument. It seems to me, and I've made this argument elsewhere, it's much more plausible to make that relation in practice than it is in etymology of the relations between territory and terror. And just as a kind of subsequent side note to that, the suffix of the word territorium seems to me to be at least as interesting as the prefix, the aureum of territorium, the aury part of territory. We get this in other English words: crematorium, a place of death; sanatorium, a place of health; auditorium, a place of hearing, a lecture hall. And that formation of the word in English and in many other languages is out of this Latin root, but that there's two place words within the Latin territorium. There's the terra, the land or the earth, or perhaps the area from which people are frightened, and the aureum, the surrounding area around that. But having Anglo-Saxon and therefore Germanic words in the language alongside Latin, Norman French heritage ones, isn't unusual in modern English. There's many instances where we have words that appear synonyms that come from those different language groups that make up English. But there's a third set of words in English deriving from the Greek root of this notion of the earth, the gai. This is the word forms the root part of words such as geography, geology, geometry, and geopolitics. Literally, an earth writing, an earth knowledge or an earth science, an earth measuring, and an earth politics. But in all of those today, in a sense, I think we're perhaps losing the element of the geo, the earth, and replacing it with other ideas. So as I suggested at the beginning, geopolitics is being reconceived as global politics. Geometry is a branch of mathematics, abstract and detached. Geography no longer seems to be earth writing, but rather often a very loose spatial sensibility to work that could equally have been done in international relations, in sociology, in cultural studies. And it's perhaps only in geology that we still find that true inheritor of the etymological sense of the term, the logos of the geo. But as Robert Freudeman notes, this is a philosopher who's tried to work on the relation between philosophy and the earth sciences, he suggests that the term geology, which once identified exclusively with the study of the solid earth, now as the planet, has lost ground to earth sciences, which are meant to highlight the need for an integrated study of air, water, soil, rock, ice, and biota. So the earth sciences as a study of the earth, the planet in its entirety, whereas geology was a study in a narrower sense of the earth as an element. But the Greeks had a special significance for the notion of the geo. Aristotle tells us that Empedocles is the first to speak of the four material elements, contrasting three of them, earth, air, and water, to the fourth, fire. Aristotle later tells us that Hesiod said that the earth was the first of the bodies that came to be. And Aristotle himself suggests that the reason that heavy things fall downwards is that they are earthy, whose natural place is below. This is Aristotle's explanation of what we come to call gravity. Aristotle claims that certain things have as their very nature the earthiness to them, which tends downwards, whereas other things have an aerial aspect to them, which tends upwards. This is the way that Aristotle in the Physics makes sense of movement of bodies. And he talks about this in other places. So in the Metrologica, for example, he's talking about the different kinds of processes within the earth that produce things that we find when we dig in the earth. And he's talking about the different types of what he calls exhalation, of vapours within the earth, producing two distinctive kinds of things that could be found in there. I'm not going to read the whole passage, but it's the distinction that he's making between taharutka, normally translated as fossils, and to metalumina, metals. And he's talking about the different processes that create these two different things. Now, the Latin word fossil, which used to mean anything that was dug up from the earth, has now got a much narrower sense of the mineral remains of organic life. But fossil, coming from the word fossa, a ditch, something that is dug, used to mean what Aristotle means here. But Aristotle's understanding here is the one that's dominant throughout the Middle Ages in writers such as Albertus Magnus and Georgius Agricola of thinking about this. So Aristotle here trying to think about earth sciences or geology in a quite literal sense of the logos of the geo of the earth itself. But Aristotle's already, even 2,500 years ago, recognising that there's beginning to be this separation away from the sciences that look at the earth from the earth itself. So he says, for example, in the Metaphysics, that the geometry differs from measurement of the earth only in that the latter deals with what we perceive, whereas the former deals with the unperceived. Now, Aristotle's using this to justify reflection on practices rather than just analysis of the practices themselves. But he's I think, anticipating the way that geometry becomes more and more distanced from, say, the way that the ancient Egyptians understood it. You find this in Herodotus with his account of the Nile floods every year, and that the land surveyors would go out after the Nile had flooded to remark the boundaries of the different farmers' fields. This is the origin of the notion of geometry, literally an earth measuring. Now, geometry becomes more and more abstract through Euclid, through Descartes, and so on. It comes more and more distanced from this notion of an actual physical measuring of the earth. The last thing I want to say about the Greeks is how important earth is to their politics. The Greek myths of autochthony, for instance, about the very rootedness of being born from the very soil itself, have at least a twofold root. There's the Athenian and Theban myths that combine autos, the self, with kthon, soil or earth, but there's also the Platonic idea of gegenis, being born, gen, of the earth, ge. So there's examples in Greek myth and Greek tragedy, the birth of the first king of Athens from the very soil itself after the failed rape of the goddess Athena, which is where the Athens gets its name from, the woman who was attempted to be raped. The semen was spilled on the ground, the semen fertilised the soil, and the first king, Erechthonos, was born from the soil itself. Or the dragon's teeth, which were sown into the ground and then sprung forth as the dragon kings that were the founders of the city of Thebes. Or you get the noble lie in Plato's Republic, the idea that it doesn't matter whether it's true that people are actually born from this very place, but it's politically powerful and useful, and it will create a sense of a community, it will create a sense of people feeling an attachment to the very place that they're from, and therefore it's a politically expedient thing to do. And all of these, in a sense, give rise to notions of noble birth, of rootedness in a particular location, of attachment to place, but also crucially of a disavowal of women in the birth of kings and warriors. If they're born from the very soil themselves, the role of women in giving birth to them can be marginalised within this. Now, it's sometimes suggested that the Anglo-Saxon roots of English give a more rudimentary, earthy sense to the language than the French or Latin roots. We sometimes even hear it said that things are Anglo-Saxon, particularly when people are talking about language, profanity or crude words, for example. Earthy or earthly are also sometimes used as a descriptor of worldly concerns as opposed to spiritual concerns. So to understand things like the profane, the non-spiritual, the secular. St. Augustine, for example, distinguishes between the city of God and the earthly city and notes that man in Genesis is born out of the dust of the earth. And the heaven and earth contrast is found throughout the Old and the New Testament and relates to important medieval notions of the distinction between eternal spiritual power, on the one hand, the power that the papacy has, and temporal, secular, earthly power, on the other hand, the power that the emperors, that kings, that princes, that free cities, and so on have. And a parallel project to what I'm trying to do here with earth could be done with the notion of soil, the blood and soil, Blut und Boden of Nazi discourse, or it could be done as a parallel project to the notion of land, homeland, fatherland, motherland, the promised land, the holy land, Eretz Israel, land of our fathers, and so on. And if we start to think of earth as it might relate to soil and land and to the Greek myths of autochthony, I think we can get a sense of how the reactionary politics is not very far away from an appeal to earth as the foundation for politics. So a geopolitics that's a politics of the earth rather than a politics of the globe might really easily collapse into that reactionary politics. Friedrich Ratzel's notion of Lebensraum, Martin Heidegger's distinction between earth and world and his reimaginings of autochthony, Carl Schmitt's nomos of the earth, all of these partnered by deeply unpleasant racist politics. And Schmitt trying to make this argument from a Greek foundation of the notion of nomos as a law but also as a division, and arguing that nomos is the measure by which the ground and soil of earth, the Grund und Boden der Erde, in a particular order is divided and situated, and then forming a whole set of political consequences that follow from that point. And that Schmitt is arguing of this way of understanding a politics based on an earth, a soil, and the division of that between competing polities. Heidegger tries to work through these questions in the 1930s, the mid-1930s. He's thinking, well, this is one of Heidegger's large arguments, that the Roman-Latin translation of Greek thought takes over the Greek words into thought, but without a corresponding equally original experience of what they say without that Greek word. And he calls this bodenlosigkeit, rootlessness, or a lack of soil, or a lack of grounding in the soil. And he talks about the opposite of this, a bodenständigkeit, a rootedness, a standing in the soil, an autochthony in thought, that German, he thinks, shares with Greek that originary rootedness, autochthony, in terms of the relation between the words and the concepts that they're signifying. Now, Heidegger tries to work these through in two main ways in his thought in the 1930s. One is through a reading of the poet Friedrich Hölderlin, appealing to this notion of earth, appealing to the notion of homeland through that notion of the earth, and saying that the earth of the homeland is not simply a space that's delimited by exterior frontiers, a natural region, a locality, an örtlichkeit. The earth is something that is readied for the gods. This is something that he tries to draw through the German nationalism, through Hölderlin, to try to understand not a simple geopolitical in a narrow sense of this notion, but about a kind of a rootedness in the soil politics that he's thinking about. The more famous example that he gives is of his reading of a painting by Van Gogh, which he takes, and there's a big dispute about whether this is actually what this painting is of. Heidegger says these are a pair of peasant shoes. Other people say, no, they were Van Gogh's own boots and he walked in cities with them. But Heidegger thinks they were a pair of peasant shoes, that they were used by a peasant woman. So a painting by Van Gogh, a pair of rough peasant shoes, nothing else. The painting really represents nothing. But as to what is in that picture, you're immediately alone with it, as though you yourself are making your way wearily home with your hoe on a late autumn evening after the last potato fires have died down. And in the Origin of the Work of Art essay, Heidegger elaborates on this theme. He's talking about the way that he can suggest that through looking at these shoes, he can start to get a sense of the attachment to the earth that the peasant woman who'd have worn those shoes would have had, but also a sense of how this piece of equipment, these shoes, functions within her world and structures of the relations between her, this object, and the other kind of things that he starts to elaborate through these questions. It's one of Heidegger's more, I mean, Heidegger's a terrible writer quite a lot of the time, but this is one of Heidegger's more sort of poetic moments where he's trying to invoke these relations between earth and world that are signified by this piece of equipment in there. But there's this notion of the soil in there, not simply, I think, as soil, as in, well, obviously a peasant woman is going to be encountering soil in a fairly simple sense, but also this relation to the notion of Boden, which in 1930s Germany is not a neutral term to use in terms of the relation this has to our National Socialist discourse. Now, Heidegger later thinks and understands that this relation that he was trying to draw through Hölderlin's poetry, through this reading of Van Gogh, has very little to do with the way that Nazi discourse was trying to appropriate this attachment to earth and land. But even in that text where he's talking about this relation of the earth to soil, to the destiny of a historical people, das Volk, even if he's trying to think this through as history and geography rather than biology and so on, this relation is far too close for comfort. It's one of the more problematic parts of Heidegger's philosophical work as opposed to Heidegger's more explicitly political work, which has much more obvious problems. But I think the philosophical work here is deeply intertwined with the politics of what he's trying to think here. And we can continue this into the present day. Calls for religious, national, cultural rights to promised lands can be found in a whole range of instances. Serbian claims to Kosovo, Israel's claims to the West Bank, Argentina's claim to Las Malvinas, other contested territories across the world, Western Sahara, Kashmir, and self-determination movements the world over. So Earth as a ground for politics seems destined to replicate the very worst gestures of colonial, settler, aggressive, expansionist geopolitics. What I'm trying to think through is whether there might be a potential in other places for thinking this a different way of imagining space, a different way of imagining the Earth and the geo, whether there's resources perhaps in Deleuze and Guattari's work on geophilosophy, or particularly, and this is what I'll talk more about, is Elizabeth Gross's notion of geopower, whether there's something in here that we can use to think about geopolitics as earth politics in a way that maybe escapes some of those problems. Now, the relation that Deleuze and Guattari propose in Thousand Plateaus first, between deterritorialization, reterritorialization, it seems to me that that requires much more careful interrogation if we're to try and use it to understand contemporary political geographical questions, or the way that, say, Hart and Negri use it in Empire to understand the New World Imperium. It's not at all clear to me that the way that those terms are being used in their work is the same as the way it's being used in the people that appropriate them, or that even when they talk about something like the notion of territory, that they actually mean the same thing that political geographers mean by the question of territory. But this notion of geophilosophy perhaps has some potential in it, particularly in a way that Elizabeth Gross has picked up on this idea. She's suggesting that there's a fundamental distinction between earth and territory, and this is really the thing I want to say something about here. Because what she's making a claim is that territory has something added to it from the earth, that it is framed, it has qualities, that it is ordered and constructed. So some kind of process, some kind of qualities have been added to the chaos of the earth itself to produce the thing that she's calling, after Deleuze and Guattari, territory. The frame, she says, is what establishes territory out of the chaos that is the earth. The frame is thus the first construction, the corners of the plane of composition, and so on. She's talking about the way that territory gets produced through these transformations, and that territory is not something that's pre-given, it's not something, in a sense, ahistorical, but it's produced through a particular set of processes then. Now, for Gross, I think following Deleuze, there's a kind of vitalist element to this, a kind of vibrancy to it, that territory and body go together in this sense. Both of them are framed and ordered. Territory and body, she says, only emerge as such to the extent that such qualities can be extracted. Now, I'm suspicious of this vitalist element because in the work on territory, the existing literature on territory, the vitalist element gets so closely associated with the literature on territoriality, which for me is a distinct concept from territory that shouldn't be collapsed into it, and I have a suspicion to that kind of way of thinking. But I do like the way that Gross is trying to think about territory as a process, as something that can be understood as this kind of tangled multiplicity of a range of relations, and I've tried to make sense of those as political, economic, strategic, legal, technical, and so on. Now, if Deleuze and Guattari are not using the notion of territory, perhaps in the same way that others are, to what extent is Gross able to make that translation, in a sense, of moving the concepts over into those questions? There's other complications in Thousand Plateau. Deleuze and Guattari use the word la terre, which in English, the English translation by Brian Massumi is translated as either earth or land, depending on context. So there's one concept for Deleuze and Guattari, there's two in the English translation in the work that's picked up on those questions. But I do think there might be something, if we go backwards, not so much on the question of territory, but on the question of earth in Gross, that might be useful to think through these questions. And I'm not going to read all of these passages, but it's about the way that she's trying to think about what the earth might be through this relation to territory, through this relation to the framing of those kinds of questions. Now, this work, it seems, has taken a little while for geographers to pick up on, perhaps the potential in this work. But there was a discussion at the Association of American Geographers in 2012, where a panel of geographers were trying to engage with Elizabeth Gross, who was there, who gave an opening presentation and then responded to questions around these questions, which was published in Society and Space. Now, in that, there was a call for, could we use Gross, could we use Gross's work to think a more active sense of the geo in geopolitics? And that what Gross had to say in the beginning, in her opening remarks to this, the relations between the Earth and its various forces and living beings, and they're not always distinguishable forces, are forms of geopower. If power is to be conceived as the engagement of clashing competing forces, power, the relations between humans, or perhaps even between living things, is a certain historically locatable capitalization on the forces of geopower. Now, it seems to me there is something really quite useful in this, and that work could be done to elaborate the potentials that come out of this, of thinking of politics of the earth that would take into account the power of natural processes and natural resources, the dynamics of human environment, the interrelation of objects outside of human intervention, the relation between the biosphere, the atmosphere, and the lithosphere, the complex interrelations that produce, continually transform, and rework the question of territory and state spatial strategies. Manuel Delandes tried to sketch some of this in the book A Thousand Years of Nonlinear History. Literary theorist Jonathan Bate has looked at the ways that poetry can retrieve a connection to the earth. John Protevi, in a forthcoming book on Deleuze and the sciences, has suggested the hybrid multiplicity of this can only be understood through what he calls the geo-hydro-solar-biotechnical politics, to make sense of all of those different connections. And in a related inquiry, I think Jane Bennett has wanted to retrieve an active earthy sense to what she calls vibrant matter. So this renewed politics of the earth will be appropriate to the complexities of space and territory in multiple dimensions, rather than simply a tendency to imagine political space as a surface or an area. As well as the work on vertical geopolitics, there's also a need, I think, for an analysis of the depth of power, looking at the subsoil, looking at tunnels, infrastructure, foundations. Eyal Weissman, many of you will know for his work Hollow Land, thinking about the multiple dimensions of the West Bank, but recently has also begun to propose an idea of what he calls forensic architecture, a means to understand and comprehend the deep surface of the earth, another way to think about this politics of the earth. Matthew Hammer has noted that we should think about biopower rather than biopolitics, with biopolitics being a particular and narrower set of questions within biopower. So it is, I think, with geopower, a broader category within which geopolitics operates. So within that wider rethinking of geopower, perhaps then we can resituate what we mean by geopolitics as a politics of the earth. And that geopolitics would sit alongside, rather than replace, the attention that's given to biopolitics. It's not an either-or kind of question for me here. Just as I think Foucault is misguided when he says that population came to displace territory as the object of government, so too, I think, is a misguided appropriation of biopolitics at the expense of geopolitics. For me, the work I've done on territory has suggested that the very strategies turned towards the object and constitution of population are similarly directed towards the object and constitution of territory, which should be understood much more as a process than an outcome, more as a political technology than as a container for political action. And it seems to me that it's exactly the same kinds of techniques directed towards population that are central to the idea of territory, calculative techniques, modes of measuring and controlling, that find their expression in things such as land surveying, terrain analysis, cartographic practices, administrative strategies, statistical surveys, legal codes, and military technologies. So just as there is biopower and biopolitics, there's a notion of biometrics, this similarly geopower, geopolitics, but also I'd like to retrieve a notion of geometrics. Not simply geometrics as that abstract sense of geometry that we have today, but in the traditional sense, a measuring of the earth. Not simply in the way of land surveying, although I think that's important, but also the measurings of the yields of oil and gas, the measurements of soil fertility, air quality, population density. Population density, of course, being a relation of number to area, bridging biopolitics and geopolitics. So how would our thinking then of geopower, geopolitics and geometrics work if we took the earth, the air and the subsoil, questions of land, terrain, territory, earth processes and understandings of the world as the central terms that are at stake in that word geopolitics, rather than a looser sense of the global? And it's that kind of politics of the earth that I'm trying to begin to think through, in a sense something that might actually be appropriate to what people are calling the Anthropocene. Thank you.